This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 11th episode of The Quarter Bin, I'm looking at Micronauts number 6 from Marvel Comics, cover dated June 1979. Micronauts number 6 had a cover price of 40 cents, meaning I acquired this comic for only a 38% discount. Not really that big a bargain, actually. The story, The Great Escapes, was written by Bill Mantlo, with art by Michael Golden and Joseph Rubinstein. The cover shows a few of the Micronauts attacking a highway patrol car, which does sort of happen in the issue. And Rubinstein's art does exactly what it needs to for this title. The gist of the Micronauts is their tiny size, and so the artistic challenge is all about scale. But the cover gives us the idea that Bug and a Croyer are very small compared to the police officer and his vehicle. Princess Mari is a bit too big, maybe twice the size of her colleagues, but still much smaller than a normal human. And she is the focal point of the cover, and she's a cute female. So a discrepancy in size counts as legitimate artistic interpretation, as far as I'm concerned. The issue itself starts with a kid running down a hallway, a handful of tiny beings flying next to him, firing tiny weapons at a group of robotic security guards who are giving chase. A dog running next to the boy says, "Keep going, we've got to get Steve to safety." But as I look closer, it's actually a Micronaut who we'll come to know as Bug who says that. Bug is riding the dog, and for a second, I really did think that it was a talking dog. I was quite confused by this splash page. But that's the risk you run with a comic featuring teeny tiny characters. Within the next page or two, while the chase and battle ensue, we get brought up to speed on just what is happening here. The boy is Steve Coffin, and he and his dog Muffin and the Micronauts are fleeing Prometheus Labs, which is housed along with NASA and other science-type entities in the Human Engineering Life Laboratories Complex. Let me say that again. Human Engineering Life Laboratories. Yes, the initials are indeed H-E double hockey sticks. Steve is crying as he flees, for his father, Ray Coffin, has fallen into a mysterious pit inside the building. "But he may not be dead, Steve," one of our tiny heroes tells him. "The Prometheus Pit is a passageway between the Microverse and Earth, and if we get out of this alive, I swear we'll help you find your father." Microtron shorts out a fire door to buy some time. Commander Rand contacts Biotron to see if he's repaired the Endeavor, which I am right in assuming is their flying craft. But they can't come to the phone right now, as they've been cornered by the Coffin's pet cat, who looms over them ominously. Again, the scale and perspective is portrayed wonderfully in this panel. Steve has to get back into the Hell Building to alert NASA about Prometheus's evil doings. His father, Ray, is an astronaut. Steve does bluff his way back in, but the guards catch sight of the little aliens trailing behind, and they have to flee out of the building again. The head of security wonders why his guards are chasing a boy and his dog. And Steve makes it to his dad's pickup truck, which his father has just barely taught him a very little bit about almost how to drive. As the robot guards burst out of the building, guns blazing, in the crossfire, Steve puts the truck in gear. Just then, the Micronauts' base ship, the Astro Station, flies by with Bug at the helm, who is just about as skilled a driver as Steve is. The ship crashes into the bed of the pickup truck, just before the truck itself crashes through the gate. We shift scenes to join Steve's father, Ray, and Philip Prometheus, the men who fell into the eerie pit inside the Hell Lab, falling through an endless, shifting subatomic cosmos for what seems a lifetime, Ray Coffin and Philip Prometheus drop into eternity. "Phil, you invented the pit. There must be some way out." "No way out. We're doomed." Ray begins to glow, and he tells Prometheus that he feels someone calling him, and he vanishes. A being simply called the Time Traveler introduces himself, and Ray is teleported to a different place within the Microverse and teleported completely out of the rest of this issue. Left all alone and still falling, Prometheus fears for his safety and for his sanity. A probe detects Prometheus and heads for Homeworld. Instead of landing at the dreaded body banks of Baron Karzna, the undisputed monarch of Homeworld, the probe takes its message to the Shadow Temple. Several hours later, the High Shadow Priests inform Karzna of the breach of the walls between the Microverse and Earth, and the dictator dispatches a fleet to investigate. Karzna is displeased that the Shadow Priest is pulling some sort of political power play on him by summoning him, the undisputed monarch, to their temple. Far below the body banks, the rightful Prince Argon rots in his cell, until a hot chick blasts a hole in the Prince Argon's cell and frees him. For not only is she a hot girl, she's a hot resistance commander with a super sexy name of Slug. What? Slug? Really, Mantlo? Really? I mean, I guess it's better than Stiletta. Editor's note, the name Stiletta is a reference to episode 6 of this podcast. Oh, did I mention that Prince Argon was transformed into a centaur by Baron Karzna? Well, he was, and he does not like it. But Slug will have none of his whining. "I've seen Karzna do far worse to others, whose only crime was to remain loyal to you, my prince. The underground needs its leader. Will you abandon it now out of self-pity?" And then Slug mounts him and rides him right out of the prison. Back in Florida, Steve manages to guide the truck back to his house. When he opens the tool shed, the cat flies out. Either the mammals on this planet fly without wings, or we've just seen a display of Biotron's biotronic strength. Biotron is ready to power up the ship. Steve plugs it into the circuit box, saying he feels like Scotty from Star Trek. The whole neighborhood goes dark from the massive power drain, but the ship lifts off. The radar at the local Air Force base notices the blip, but leaves it to the highway patrol to chase down the bogey. So quickly, two patrol cars try to intercept Steve and the Micronaut ship, which is hovering just above the truck. The Micronauts once again have to defend themselves, and here we get the scene from the cover, where the Micronauts blast away at the chasing police vehicle. A Kroyer and Bug bust up the windshield of the police cars, and Princess Mari, an elite marksman, shoots out their tires. "The Giant's vehicles appear to be disabled, Commander. They've given up the chase. Jam the radios, Biotron. We don't want them calling for help." So, Commander Rand leads the Micronauts to the Coffin family fishing cabin in the Everglades. The Commander wants to find a place to rest and make plans to return to the Microverse. It's time we brought the war back to Baron Karzna. The last page of the issue takes us back into the Microverse. Karza's fleet reaches Prometheus floating in inner space. The mind probes I've sent out reveal that this one met and fought with the Micronauts, and was driven mad by the encounter. Yet I sense an evil in him, not different from my own. Evil, which I can make use of.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters? Or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
And we're back. And I have a confession to make. I neither owned nor played with Micronauts growing up. And here's the even harder part to admit. I never actually played with any action figures that I can remember. The closest was that one Christmas in the mid-70s. I saw in the Sears catalog, and then begged for, and then got, an awesome toy vehicle from an action figure line. In my mind, it was a G.I. Joe item, but I have no idea if that's technically correct. But what the toy was a combination helicopter, pontoon boat, seaplane of some kind, and it was awesome. I remember playing with it in a swimming pool, and my memory must have been 18 inches, 24 inches, and I remember it being mostly yellow, orange, gold in color. Remember that it was more than 35 years ago, so the details may not be quite as I remember them. When the Micronauts were hot in the late 70s and early 80s, I was more likely reading sci-fi, putting together a jigsaw puzzle, watching sports on TV, maybe even playing a little backyard baseball, maybe playing Stratego or Risk, or the awesome Avalon Hill baseball and football strategy games. Lots of things, but not playing with action figures. Currently, my entire action figure collection consists of a pair of 3-inch Dr. Dooms that sit in a bookcase in my university office. Suffice it to say that I came to this issue with little working knowledge of the Micronauts. All I knew about them was that they were small, and that they came from inner space, though I didn't quite know what that was. A lot of classic sci-fi has to do with microscopic civilizations, or maybe the idea that we're the microscopic civilization. So I was comfortable with the concept when I read this story for the first time just a few weeks ago. My impression reading this was, wow, what a difference 30-plus years makes. This book barely resembles the slick, expensive books that have been produced the last decade or so. By that, I mean stuff happens in this issue. I mean a ton of stuff happens in this issue. In the promo for this podcast, which many podcasters have been kind enough to play, I joke about $4 comics that you can read in 4 minutes, and that's a bit of an exaggeration. It usually takes me 6 to 8 minutes to read a modern comic. This issue took me a good 20 to 25 minutes, and I really appreciated that. The text boxes, the dialogue, it was not the over-the-top bombast that you could get from Marvel in the 60s and early 70s. I know there's something charming about Stan Lee's writing style back then, but this was a much more modern style. It was all about moving the story forward, both the events of the issue and the overall arc in the greater Micronauts epic. I was a little lost for a page and a half as this book starts right in the middle of the action, Steve running away from the robot security guards. But I got the gist of the story very quickly, and even figured out who the different Micronauts were. It helped that we were only in a few locations here on the surface world, and we stayed in each location for long chunks of pages. The first 6 pages were here, the next 5 in the Microverse, 5 back here, and then the last page in the Microverse. That gave us time in each place to dig into that storyline, as opposed to a lot of fast cutting back and forth. And that made it seem like these scenes were chapters in a longer novel. I just noticed something, though, and by just noticed, I mean like a minute ago, when I broke down the page count by location. There were only 17 pages of story in this book out of the 32 pages. That surprised me, but I don't feel cheated because it was a dense read. I've been trained to think of a comic as having 20 to 22 pages of story, but I guess I wasn't counting those pages when I was a kid. I heaped praise on Bill Mantlo back in episode 5 when we talked about an issue of ROM Space Knight, and he is just as much on his game here. Mantlo began writing for Marvel in 1974, and at this point in his career, 5 years later, he was also writing Tarzan and Spectacular Spider-Man. The first issue of ROM is about 6 months away, and at about that time, he starts a pretty long run on Incredible Hulk. But he seemed to specialize in licensed properties, writing Conan and Red Sonja and Transformers during his career, in addition to Micronauts and, of course, every issue of ROM. This issue was non-stop action, and managed to be both epic in its sweep, but also personal and small enough to deliver solid character moments. There's drama and action and political intrigue, and just enough humor to break the tension when needed, specifically the two scenes with the cat. The only part of the plot I couldn't figure out is why they had to go back into the building after getting out, just to get chased out again. Yes, we learned about the father and the Prometheus pit, but those pages were mostly an excuse for another chase sequence. But that is a minor quibble. Mantlo is a great world builder, both here and in ROM, where I'm more familiar with the storytelling. But the 6 pages or so we spend in the microverse are more than enough to reveal the layers of political drama and intrigue that Mantlo's getting at. Even from just one issue, I know there is a heck of a lot going on here. I am fascinated by this world, and I want to know more of it. I know that I have another Micronauts issue in the Quarterbin database, and if I find more in the actual Quarterbins at my LCS, I am definitely picking them up. Well worth every one of the 25 pennies I spent. That does not wrap up my coverage of Micronauts 6, because there are some other interesting things in this issue, and I will cover them right after this.
The Vietnam War, a conflict that changed America. Of those who served, many came back irrevocably changed, while many did not come back at all. This is their story. Marvel Comics presents The Nom. Join me, Tom Paneris, for In Country, a podcast that covers Marvel Comics series The Nom. Each episode, I will recap and review one issue of the series, as well as provide historical context that's important to understanding the events behind the story. Along the way, I will also take a look at the movies, music, and literature surrounding the Vietnam War. New episodes are posted every 2 weeks at incountry.podomatic.com. You can find show notes and other media at popcultureaffidavit.com.
And we're back. Again. As action-packed and just plain old-fashioned fun as that story was, I also found a few worthwhile things to talk about in the non-story sections of the book. First, the letters page, which includes one very well thought out and detailed fan letter worth mentioning. This was an in-depth critique of the storytelling and characters from Micronauts number 2, reflecting a knowledge of writing and was itself a very well written letter. It was from a teenaged Kurt Busiek. According to Wikipedia, he was a prolific writer to letters pages. In just 4 years from here, he'd have a backup story appear in Green Lantern, and a year or two later wrote a miniseries for Red Tornado. And then his career was off and running, including long stints at all the major comic publishers. Busiek's masterwork, of course, is the award-winning Astro City, recently beginning a new series at Vertigo. Billy Hogan has mentioned on the Superman Fan Podcast that he's picking up that new title monthly, and I'm interested in going back and picking up some of the older ones. I've looked at letter pages in all the issues selected for the Quarterbin podcast,
and this is the first time I've recognized the name. The bottom third of the letter page includes the Micronauts alphabet, which Michael Golden had been sneaking into the issues, and about which eagle-eyed letter writers had inquired. That was cool. I usually don't spend a lot of time on the advertisements either, but this issue had a couple I wanted to mention. The back cover contained the Spalding Streetball ad with Rick Barry and Dr. J. I swear this was on every comic I read through the mid-80s. And as much as I love that ad, that was not the highlight of the ads in this issue. For lo, verily, there was a Hostess ad. And they have been dramatized on many a podcast before. Perhaps this exact one has been dramatized before. But never has one been dramatized in this podcast feed. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Spider-Man in Hotshot on the Block.
Oops, that was too close for comfort. My old enemy Hotshot must be all fired up again.
You'll be a pile of ashes when I really turn on the heat, Webhead.
It's going to be a hot time in the old town tonight. My fire-resistant webbing can take whatever you throw at me, Hotshot. Luckily, I'm a swinger, too. If I don't get old Hotshot to turn off the heat, this cookie will be burned to a crisp. But I've got a great idea. Even Hotshot can't send fireballs at me and eat Hostess Twinkies cakes at the same time.
Golden sponge cake, creamed filling. That's a Hotshot combination, if I ever tasted one.
Hotshot isn't so hot anymore, thanks to Hostess.
I'll just hang around here and enjoy some more Hostess Twinkies cakes.
You get a big delight in every bite of Hostess Twinkies cakes.
The gender-swapped role of Spider-Man was played by Emily, the hostess of Uncovering the Bronze Age and co-hostess of the Short Box Showcase. The verdict on Micronauts 6 is totally positive. This is a quarter-bin steal. A great read at the original price of 40 cents, even better at 25 cents. That does, finally, wrap up my coverage of Micronauts 6, bringing episode 11 of the Quarterbin Podcast to a close. In episode 12, we'll be looking at another Marvel book that's well over 30 years old, Moon Knight number 11, cover dated September 1981. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until then, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Professor!